Welcome to Holden Village. Tonight in the Fireside Room, Bob Keller will be speaking on Chief Seattle, the Fifth Gospel. So let's listen in on Bob.
I'd like to give you a choice before we get started, but I don't want to take 20 minutes to make the choice or defeat the purpose of having the choice. We're starting at about 20 after 8. I realize you've had a long day. Some of you have had 3 classes already today. The way I normally do this takes an hour and a half. It's not a lecture. I'm not going to stand up and just lecture at you. It's a more interactive or group involvement type procedure. And because of that, because I ask you to do a lot of the thinking and a lot of the work, it doesn't necessarily just speed along. I can't zip along like Diane was doing this afternoon, covering all that material. And I can do that, but if I'm going to involve, or if you're going to be involved, it just takes more time. Everybody needs time to think and share ideas and disagree, so on. If we do that, go about it that way, which is what I did the last time. What I normally do, I said it'll take about an hour and a half. We probably won't be done until 9:45 or so. That's fine with me. The other option is to shorten it and spend our time talking about the implications of what we would find out through the inquiry. I would tell you sort of the conclusions that you would reach if you start thinking carefully about Chief Seattle's speech, sort of short-circuit it, tell you what the conclusions are, and then ask you to discuss and debate, argue, share ideas about what you make of those conclusions. What difference does it make, what you come to think about something like Chief Seattle's speech. We can do that, I'm sure we can cut that one off whenever we want. We can do that for 40 minutes, an hour, or whatever. So the time's more easily controlled on the second one. The first one, once we get into it, I'd like to pursue it to the end. I don't want to cut that off partway there. Does anybody have any strong preferences? Or?
I think perhaps I would suggest we choose the second alternative, because in addition to the classes that many of these people went to, many went on a 9-mile hike or lesser hikes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I went on a 10-mile hike today, but that's not behind this. So. Okay.
I would second that.
Okay. Unless somebody very strongly objects, we'll take the second approach. If someone's interested in all the thinking and documents and information that leads up to the second approach, I can share some of that with you tomorrow if you ever have time between your classes or breakfast. Or I can give you some bibliography where you can go read about this elsewhere. Okay, I will take some time now to set up the question. Chief Seattle was a Duwamish and Squamish Indian who lived on Puget Sound, was born on Puget Sound, the west side of Puget Sound, about 1790. That's the time when the first Europeans are beginning to arrive in the Northwest. By the time Washington had become a territory, he was about 55 years old. It was about 1850, 1855. At that time, he, like all the other native people in the Northwest, faced a choice of what to do in reaction to the white people who were flooding in and occupying what had been his ancestral land. The government decided to negotiate a treaty with the Indians of the Northwest in the Puget Sound. They sent a man out named Isaac Stevens to do that, negotiated the treaty, and at the treaty council, where the treaty was signed, Chief Seattle supposedly gave his famous speech. It's a speech to the governor about signing this treaty and giving up all the land and recognizing that his people are no longer going to control, own the Pacific Northwest. That's where the speech comes from. The speech sort of lay dormant for at least a century or more. It was supposedly given in 1855. In the 1970s, it suddenly became very famous. And it's evolved in the last 20 years from being just famous in the United States and the Northwest to being famous around the world. There are people in Japan and China and Norway, especially in England and Germany, who not only know about this speech, but read it, have copies of it. It's been put on records. It's been part of film scripts. It's all over the world. The expression, Chief Seattle speech, the fifth gospel, comes from a comment made by a Roman Catholic archbishop in England, who said, Chief Seattle speech is the fifth gospel for our time. The speech shows up in many different places. I'll show you a few examples of this. That shows up in the Holden bookstore, among other places.
How long did he live?
Chief Seattle lived until 1866, about 10 years after he gave the speech. I'm looking for the Holden. Have you seen the copy in the bookstore?
Yeah.
Here it is. This is in the Holden bookstore. It's called, We May Be Brothers and Sisters After All, We Shall See, A Message from Chief Seattle. It's very nicely printed. There's another version of it. Here's a very popular version that came out a couple of years ago. It's called Brother Eagle, Sister Sky by Susan Jeffers. It's a child's version, Chief Seattle speech. On the New York Times bestseller list is nonfiction for 17 weeks. It was as high as number 5. It was on there, up there about number 5 or 6, and I was watching it, and all of a sudden it just disappeared. It just went off the list like that. And I didn't understand why that had happened until I happened to pick up the Reader's Digest one time, and I came across this article in the Reader's Digest called The Little Green Lie, which exposed this book, or at least said it exposed this book as a fraud. And that killed the sales of it. Going back to the Holden.
What did they say was fraudulent?
I'll tell you in just a minute. A couple of months ago, it was performed by the Yakima Symphony Orchestra as part of a concert. Native Americans reciting Chief Seattle speech with the orchestra in the background playing music. The Holden bookstore, there's at least 4 books that I've found that cite the speech. One is called Spiritual Ecology, A Guide to Reconnecting with Nature. Another, The Dream of the Earth. Third one, To Care for the Earth, A Call to a New Theology. And finally, The Earth Speaks. All of those cite Chief Seattle speech. And finally, just it shows up in all kinds of odd places, including on documents of Indian tribes and in sermons. But probably one of the oddest places is this. I don't know if you've seen this. Lemon Zinger tea. If you look on the back of it, it says, on the sale of Indian land, the president in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land. But how can you buy or sell the sky, the land? The idea is strange to us. And it goes on and cites that and says at the bottom, Chief Seattle. Okay, that's, the speech is very popular, is very frequently quoted. The problem with the speech, which the author of this Reader's Digest article talks about, is that it is very likely inauthentic.
The Reader's Digest.
No, the speech itself, Chief Seattle's speech. And if we were doing our regular program, what I do at this point, I give a little bit more historical background about the treaty and Governor Stevens and all that. Then I'd play the speech. At that point, I'd ask you, how would you, if you're an historian, go about analyzing Chief Seattle's speech and trying to determine if it was historically authentic? What kind of questions would you ask about it? And that's what would take us about an hour and 15 minutes to work out. And that's what I'm not going to do now. So I'm going to jump to the conclusion and tell you that if we did that, you would come to the conclusion, I think, the conclusion that I've come to, that the speech is not authentic. The fact is, there are at least five or six different versions of Chief Seattle's speech. So the first thing you have to become aware of is, which version are you listening to or are confronted by? Which version is here? Which version is she using in this book? They're often different. The earliest record of Chief Seattle's speech earliest written record does not appear until 30 years after he supposedly gave the speech. It was written by a white doctor in Seattle who claims to have heard it. When you read that version quite carefully, it becomes very, very unlikely that an illiterate Duwamish, Squamish Indian of 1855 could have had those thoughts and that language. It's also filled with what we call anachronisms, things that happen after the speech was supposedly given. For example, there's references to the railroad coming across the continent and the extermination of the buffalo. And there are other strange things in it, like references to whippoorwills and pinyon nuts and all kinds of things which just don't exist around Puget Sound. So you look at this, it just doesn't quite make sense. We can't get any further back than that. If you read the actual records of the Treaty Council where he supposedly gave the speech, the minutes show that Chief Seattle spoke. And we've got those, and they're written out, but he didn't say anything like his famous speech. He mainly just said, "We're glad you are here, white people. Give my greetings to the president. Welcome." And it's a very, very short and has nothing about the environment, nothing about the Indian disappearing or any of that. But there's a further problem in that the speech that most people are familiar with and is quoted in the ones considered the fifth gospel is not the 1887 version. And it's not the 1932 version, which is still different, which is sort of a Christianized version of it. The first version is not Christian at all. The second one is very Christian. And it's not the 1966 version. It's a 1971 version of Chief Seattle's speech that happens to have been written by a man named Ted Perry. Ed Perry was a professor at the University of Texas in the 1970s, and at Texas Christian University. And he was asked by the first, by the Southern Baptist Church to write the script for a half-hour television program celebrating the first Earth Day. So he wrote this script, and he decided what he wanted it to be was an Indian chief speaking about the environment. They wrote the script, and at the end of the TV program, and they listed the credits like they always do, instead of saying, this is a producer, this is a director, lights and everything, and script writer, instead of saying Ted Perry, it said Chief Seattle. And everybody thought this was the authentic Chief Seattle speech, which it's not. It's very, very different from even the 1887 version. So, I've skipped over all the evidence and everything, but that's sort of my conclusion, and I think if you looked at it carefully on all the different issues, you'd pretty much come to that conclusion. What I'd like to do now is to play the speech, ask you to listen to it. I'm going to play the Ted Perry version. Listen to it and ask yourself, why do you think this speech has become so popular and widespread? Why does it inspire people? Why is Holden published and is selling this little version? This is, by the way, the Ted Perry or the 1971 version of the speech.
Does it give Ted Perry credit for it?
No. Ted Perry almost never gets credit. People that do these things, do it in complete good faith. They're not trying to deceive anybody, because most people don't know this background. They've never thought about the historical questions about it. So they just assume it's authentic, and they publish it and print it. So listen to it now, knowing that it's not authentic. And ask this question, why has it become so popular? And then the main question I'd like to have you discuss and think about is, does it make any difference who wrote it? What difference does it make who the real author was or when it was really given? If you think it does make a difference, why? Or if you think it really doesn't make any difference, how would you explain that?
The president in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land. You buy our land. But how can you buy or sell the sky or the land? The idea is strange to us. If we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? Every shining part of this earth is sacred to my people. Every shining pine needle, every shining shore, every mist in the dark woods, every meadow, every humming insect, all are holy in the memory and experience of my people. We know the sap which courses through the trees, as we know the blood that courses through our veins. We are part of the earth, and it is part of us. The perfumed flowers are our sisters. The bear, the deer, the great eagle, these are our brothers. The rocky crests, the juices in the meadow, the body heat of the pony and man all belong to the same family. The shining water that moves in the streams and rivers is not just water, but the blood of our ancestors. If we sell you our land, you must remember that it is sacred. Each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lake tells of events and memories in the life of my people. The water's murmur is the voice of my father's father. The rivers, they are our brothers. They quench our thirst. They carry our canoes. They feed our children. So you must give to the rivers the kindness you would give to any brother. If we sell you our land, remember that the air is precious to us, that the air shares its spirit with all life it supports. It is the wind that gave our grandfather his first breath. It is the wind that receives his last sigh. The wind also gives our children the spirit of life. So, if we sell you our land, you must keep it apart as a place where man can go and experience the sacred. Keep the land as a place where man can go to taste the wind that is sweetened by the meadow flowers. Will you teach your children what we have taught our children? That the earth is our mother? Whatever befalls the earth, befalls the sons of the earth. This we know. The earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. All things are connected like the blood which unites us all. Man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself. One thing we know. Our God is also your God. We both know that the earth is precious to him, and to harm the earth is to heap contempt upon its creator. Your destiny is a mystery to us. What will happen when the buffalo are all slaughtered, the wild horses tamed? What will happen when the secret corners of the forest are heavy with the scent of many men? What will happen when the view of the ripe hills is blotted by talking wires? Where will the thicket be gone? Where will the eagle be gone? And what is it to say goodbye to the swift pony and the hunt? That would be the end of living and the beginning of surviving. When the last red man has vanished with his wilderness and his memory is only the shadow of a cloud moving across the prairie, will these shores and forests still be here? Will there be any of the spirit of my people left? We love this earth as a newborn loves its mother's heartbeat. So if we sell you our land, love it as we have loved it. Care for it as we have cared for it. Hold it in your mind. Keep forever the memory of the land as it is when you receive it. Preserve the land for all children and love it. As we are part of the land, you too are part of the land. This earth is precious to us. It is also precious to you. No man, be he red man or white man, can be apart. One thing we know. There is only one God. We are all brothers.
Are there earlier versions of it that talk about the buffalo as being eradicated, because he says, what will we do when the buffalo are gone? I mean, to me that's a prophetic speech rather than a...
It could have been, but it just happens that was written, we know that was written in 1971.
Okay, yeah. Right.
The earlier versions, some of the earlier versions talk about the buffalo actually being gone. How would you go about finding that out?
Didn't you say there were minutes of the council meeting?
Yeah, there were minutes of the council meeting. They are, the minutes in no way reflect the sentiments that you just heard. Go ahead.
Couldn't we also ask the question of how accurate and how complete were the minutes of that council?
Mm-hmm. You'd have to ask that question and try to figure that out. And one thing you'd do is to find out if there are other sources of information about that council. Mm-hmm. The problem is that when we do that, we come up with a dead end on every possible source of information. There is no contemporary record of Chief Seattle having made a long, impassioned, eloquent speech. All there is a few little lines written in the minutes.
So is there some way to find out through the Native American community themselves?
That's another tack you can take. Unfortunately, almost nothing has come down to the present time, either about Chief Seattle or his speech. That does not lead anywhere. If you wanted to ask if it was close to what he thought, you'd want to go back to the first version, which was written by a man named Henry Smith, who was a contemporary of Chief Seattle and claimed to have heard the speech given, not at the Treaty Council, but at another place and another time. Said he took notes, and then he took those notes and expanded it into the speech. So there was a contact there. The problem with that is when you read Henry Smith's version and look at it, the thought forms, the metaphors, the way of thinking are not close to what we think of as North Coast Indian ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. And they're very close to late Victorian sort of intellectual, literary person way of thinking. And we've got a lot of things that other things that Henry Smith wrote. If you compare the speech to those, it's really clear that there's a lot of Henry Smith in this, for even the first speech. Now, there still may be things that have seeped into it over that time. Also, remember, we're talking about a 30-year time period. Someone would be like us talking about something we heard in 1965 and saying we remembered this speech. Well, how accurate could we be? But something may have come down. The mistake people often make, and I guess that stands historian's hair on its end, is when they ask the question you ask, does this reflect the way Native American people thought at the time? And people say, yes, it does. That's just how they thought. And you say, well, how do you know that? Because of Chief Seattle's speech. That shows what they thought. That sort of, you can't do that. You can make some fairly sophisticated anthropological studies of, best we can tell, how Native people thought at the time they first contacted Europeans. It's hard to do that because they didn't have writing. They didn't leave records. And most of what we do know comes through Europeans, filtered through them. But from what we do know, it's not anywhere near what you just heard. That is what white people like to think Indians thought. Indians thought very differently about nature. They were not environmentalists. I mean, by what we mean by environmentalists. Their relationship with nature was very different than ours.
Okay. Don't you think it's become popular, though, because of our guilt feelings about what we did to the Indians, and we like to think that a romantic picture of them like that okay. would lead to its popularity, I would think.
Okay, did everybody hear what she said? Yeah. Yeah, I don't want you to forget what she just said. She made a very important point about our motivations for why that speech appeals to us and why it's put the way it is, and what gives it maybe power over us. So I'd like to pursue that. So, to answer your question really briefly.
What was her question?
Her question was, what are some of the differences between this one and the earliest version? Right? The earliest version is a lot longer. It talks some about the land, but mostly about giving it up. It does not talk about the web of life, about everything being connected, about the birds of the air, the eagles, and the Mother Earth. It doesn't have any of that kind of language in it, identifying with the earth, realizing that our destiny is one with the earth. Quite the contrary, the message in that speech is that the Indians are a doomed race. It says, Chisel says, my people have had their time, they are disappearing. And we're turning this land over to you. We'd like you to take care of it. We'd like you to realize, I think this is an important message, like you realize that someday you're going to have to give it up too. Nobody holds it forever. But right now, the red man's time has passed. Remember my people after we're gone. Our ghosts will be around. It's basically a statement of what's called the myth of the vanishing American. The idea the Indians were going to disappear from the face of the earth, which a lot of people believed at that time. And it says in there, Chief Seattle says in that version, my people's time is over. Your God hates the red man. Your God hates my people. Your God loves your people and protects and promotes your people. He's on your side, and we're losing. That has changed some of the later versions. None of them say God hates the Indian after 1930. Things get added about afterlife and the spirit world and all that later on. But it's mainly about a people losing and a way of life being gone, which Henry Smith was very concerned about. Because he'd lived around Puget Sound for about 40 years. He came there very early, about 1848. And this is just before statehood. And he felt like a lot of old timers do. I'm sure you know this feeling. I do. That things are going bad. And the younger generation's not taking care of things. And it was a lot better in the past. And it's sort of a, he wrote this as one of a part of six articles he was writing about Washington Territory, and he's basically saying things were a lot better back then. It's very nostalgic. And he's saying the Indians, like many other things that were good in the past, are disappearing, and the future may not be so hot. That's sort of the gist of that. Yeah.
How do today's Indians feel about Chief Seattle?
Most of them think the speech is authentic. You'd be very careful when you say most of anybody about anything, especially about Indians, because we tend to generalize them about them a lot incorrectly. Many of the tribes, at least, and some spokesmen for the tribes, think the speech is authentic. We'll use it in their literature. When it was performed in Yakima, members of the Yakima tribe recited it during the concert. Although they did say in the program notes that it was not the Ted Perry version, but the earlier version, but they thought that was authentic. It's printed in some treaty documents. It was read by an Indian at the Seattle Goodwill Games as the invocation. But interestingly, I was always waiting to get attacked by some Indians. I went around the state giving this talk, and I had one talk in Bremerton. The great-great-grandnephew or something of Chief Seattle came, and he wasn't at all bothered by what I was saying or about these problems because he knew about them. Then I gave another talk in Paulsboro, which is right next to Fort Madison Reservation where Chief Seattle is buried. That's his tribe. And there's a curator from the museum there, and he knew all about this. He wasn't surprised by anything I said, and he said, yeah, we understand how it came about and the problems with it. Some of our people don't like to hear that, and it's useful for us to sort of promote it as authentic, which we do. We sell recordings of it and so on, but we know that it's not very... We know we cannot prove Chief Seattle said it. And we certainly know that the version you just heard on the recording is in no way authentic. So the tribe, the Chief Seattle's own tribe, at least some of their leaders know about it. But a lot of people say, Indians and other people say, it doesn't make any difference who said it or when. How do you deal with that? I mean, we had one answer to that already, that we're sort of having our own conscience in some way with this.
I think it should be required that they give credit to who did write it. Adapted by Mr. Gary, whatever.
Why?
Because otherwise it's
why isn't it right?
Why isn't it right to say that somebody wrote something who didn't write it?
Because they didn't.
Because they didn't. It's sort of reverse plagiarism, isn't it?
Okay. Just come back to it, yeah. Anybody take a different position than that?
For me, I had heard that the speech wasn't authentic, but it's a terrible, terrible disappointment to think that it is, that isn't what the Indians believed, or to think that was written by a white man and then attributed to the Indians. Don't the Indians, isn't that what I hear over and over, is what they believe, what's in that poem about the earth? To think that they don't believe that, it's a disappointment to think somebody who's not in it.
Well, just to answer that last part, Indians are probably just as diverse as we are in terms of what they believe about almost anything, including the environment. And if anybody's familiar with reservations or tribal leaders or tribal council, you quickly become aware that they are not the Sierra Club on the Seattle Tribal Council. In fact, they are usually developers, interested in the field. They really need to develop their resources. And to some of them, this is just so much flowery language. There are other Indians who believe this speech or believe things very much like it, who are very strong environmentalists. And there are a lot of Indians who don't care either way. They're not concerned about these issues, just like among many of us. So Indians are not all the same. And one problem with the speech, if we leave it accepted as authentic, is that in some ways it promotes a stereotype of Indians as being more environmental than anybody else. So you might want to think, is that a good idea or not? Who would like to disagree with what she said about that we need to identify who said it? There's always somebody
to disagree with that.
I don't necessarily disagree. In fact, I'm very much a person of my culture and this period of time, and so I kind of agree with her, but I'm very aware that in other cultures, in other times, it was a very common thing to do, to write something or speak something and attribute it to a person that was highly respected and highly regarded, to give those words or those thoughts more weight.
That's a very old classical process of attributing something to somebody of authority. So one of the questions you've got to think about with your position is, to what degree does the authority of the speech, the impact of it, depend upon who said it?
Yeah. I doubt that people are most enough to get credit was given to the author. 90% probably wouldn't read it. They'd read this main poem, but that's it.
Yeah, that's true. But then should we try to enlighten them, or should we just let them proceed in their blissful ignorance?
Well, my sister who lives in Philadelphia says that Betsy Ross didn't make the flag either.
George Washington didn't cut down the cherry tree.
Yeah, right.
But maybe we're better off believing he did cut down the cherry tree. My opinion.
Okay.
That's part part of the message of the first speech, the one that was written in 1887, which is a very convenient, Chief Seattle views in that are very convenient. And that's sort of his view, somewhat his view in the minutes of the Treaty Council. He's not saying he's glad, but he's going along with it. He's giving in. He's not going to fight. He's not going to resist. Chief Seattle, from what we know about him, was a cooperator, collaborator. He was going along with the whites and not, like some of the other Indians, deciding to oppose what was happening, which is probably why he got a city named after him. It was venerated by white people. But that message is in the somewhat in the early version of the speech. It's not in the one you just heard.
Who was the chronicler of those minutes? I mean, was that the army personnel? Because frequently they were army personnel who attended those meetings and kept the minutes on. And I think because of that, much of it is suspicious as to what actually went on.
In this case, it wasn't army. They sometimes were. It was not here because the army wasn't out here at that point in very great numbers.
So was it a government official?
It was someone hired by the government to a man named Benjamin Shaw. He was hired by the government to take the minutes at the Treaty Council. It's like to hire somebody else to interpret it. There was not many government people out here at that time. There was the governor, and I don't know, he had a couple people on his staff, and that was it.
But he was on government payroll.
That's right. He was working for the government.
So it would be to the advantage of the government to have Chief Seattle quoted as saying, "I welcome your taking over my land."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that raises a whole other question of is that record correct?
Right.
You have to decide how do you decide that? Well, you look at the rest of the minutes. And one thing, the minutes seem to be fairly complete. The Treaty Council is 3 days long. The minutes are extensive. They're about 70 or 80 pages long. And it looks like the person was trying to take down most of what was said. And he did say at that Treaty Council and others, there were things clearly said against the government. It wasn't like it was all cooperated. There were Indians there who spoke against what was happening, were upset and angry, and that got recorded. So that doesn't mean it was correct with Chief Seattle, but it gives some credibility to it. One of the big problems is the question of interpretation. Chief Seattle did not speak English.
That was my question.
Nobody else spoke them. Very few people spoke the native language, so they got an interpreter, but they couldn't find anybody to interpret from the native language into English. So what they did is use a third pseudo language called Chinook jargon. Chinook jargon is a trade language of about 400 words, mostly nouns, no verbs, nouns and adjectives, no verbs, no adverbs, and nothing. It was a language just like we're going to get together and trade furs or books or whatever. How much language would we need to do this trading? We have to talk about amounts, we have to describe the things, but it's a very, very simple language. It certainly doesn't have the kind of really complex thoughts and ideas that are in the first Chief Seattle speech. Yeah.
Were the Indians paid something for the land?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they signed the treaty.
How much were they paid? 2,000?
I think it was roughly about 2 cents an acre. But they supposedly accepted it. It was all the land from the crest of the Cascade Mountains to Puget Sound, from about Seattle, from the city of Seattle north to the Canadian border. I forget how many square miles that is, but it worked out about 2 cents an acre. The government then took some of it and spent it paying for services, hiring people, like you said, blacksmiths, teachers, and others, and they paid that out of the treaty funds. At that time, if you got land through the Homestead Act, that same land through the government, you'd pay $1.25 an acre for it. So 2 cents against $1.25. But the argument was it was of no use to the Indians. In terms of their use of it, it was only worth about a couple cents an acre because they really didn't use it fully or properly. It only is worth more. Land is only worth a lot of money if it's valuable, and if you're doing something useful with it, not if it's just sitting there. So the government didn't feel, I think, that it was necessarily cheating them. I don't want to get into all that. Somebody else had a comment.
If that speech, in fact, was not written by Chief Seattle, then the next question, I think, is why has it been so widely dispersed and so widely accepted? And is it because there is a feeling that we need to do something about how we treat the land? And maybe if we think that an Indian has given us this kind of advice, we will be more willing to accept it. Is that the reason that it has been published and copied? And even though it isn't authentic, it says something that we think we should hear. And maybe should this approach should push us in the Sierra Club direction or whatever.
Yeah, well, I don't have a definitive answer to that, but do you believe that? You think? Do you agree with what you just said?
I know enough about a variety of groups who have feelings along those lines, and I think maybe if people believe that it is some voice from the past who's giving them that sort of advice, they would be more willing to accept it than if the Nature Conservancy says we can't chop down these trees because of the spotted oil, and the forest people say that's ridiculous. What's the value of a spotted owl? You know, it's that approach that is another voice saying what some groups are trying to get.
I'm keeping you on the spot instead of me, but do you think that it's more effective if people think it's a Indian chief who lived 150 years ago saying it than a Southern Baptist scriptwriter?
If you believe it's the fifth gospel, it's kind of a voice from heaven, maybe you'd accept it more. I don't know. I think that a lot of people are very frustrated at the role that the government and many other money-seeking groups are taking, and it's an effort to thwart that.
Right.
Using any means that is available.
Okay. Let's accept that the message is important. It's important that people hear it and believe it. Is it then necessary or a good thing that people believe that the message is being told to us by an Indian chief who lived 150 years ago? And if that's so, should we just let it be then? Especially if we want people to act, to accept that message and act on it.
What's the alternative? Do a lot of publicity that isn't so?
Apparently a lot of people do want it that way. If they've published these books and you're teaching subjects on it, apparently it's what a certain number of people want to believe.
That's true.
There's a certain amount of commercial interest in this. Yeah. A lot of books sold, a lot of tea sold.
Yeah.
But that's what he has to.
There's that aspect of it.
But she said also is guilt.
I know.
But the fact that it is so popular and has been so widespread has raised people's awareness more than they might have been if they hadn't had something like this.
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing.
So it's good to raise people's awareness based on falsehood.
what struck me as I was listening to this speech was the very prophetic tone of it. And that's, the prophecies have come to pass.
Yeah, that's part of what I think makes it effective. Is here's somebody looking into the future and living way back then and telling us just what we need to know now.
But if it was written in 1970, that was...
No, but if you think it was given in 1855, true. Then it is really prophetic.
Yeah. It is a little like Alice in Wonderland.
It's a means to an end, I think. It's a means to an end.
Okay, but you're still not answering my question. Is it justifiable to do it?
No, I don't think so.
So assume that it really works. And I agree with what my experience is exactly what she said, that most people, when they learn all this, will say, so what? I'm going to use it anyhow. Even scholars do that. There's books by people with PhDs that want to quote Chief Seattle's speech. If they know about it, they put a footnote in there saying, there are some problems with the speech, however. It reflects the spirit of the Native American Indians, and then they just go ahead and do it. And that's in a footnote buried in the back. I gave this talk once in one place, and there was a person in the audience who I happened to know who was a very militant atheist and very outspoken. We went sort of through this little exercise, and he got more and more impatient, and finally he stood up and said, he's a great big guy, just saying, all this academic hogwash and nitpicking is beside the point. They're out there with the bulldozers. That speech is what we've got to hear, and we have to accept it on faith. That was in Bremerton, by the way. That's Edison Fisk, you may recognize.
Maybe that answers our question.
That's his answer to it.
We're asking the question, I think, is, are the ends worth the means?
But I mean, we read fiction every day that inspires us. Mm-hmm. And it's okay, isn't it? But can't you say that it's fiction?
You can, you certainly can.
I mean, that's honest, I think.
Yeah, we're talking about whether honesty is the most effective policy. Yeah, go ahead.
I still think that, it's, even though it's history, that people choose a person who has, respect and authority, and that's a historical fact. I still think it's disrespectful, actually, to the Native Americans to, in a sense, misrepresent. I personally, just hearing today, what possibly the truth might have been, he said, he gave up, it's time, the red man's time is done. That doesn't change my opinion that there are probably, if you research, you find indigenous Native American cultures and tribes that had similar sentiments possibly to what's in this eloquent document that you had. And I would prefer to actually know which tribes are along the lines of this, actually authentically would agree with this plagiarized.
Okay, what if I said, or I'm going to say, not what if, but that's fine for you intellectuals, but we're interested, like she's been saying, in the mass of people. And things that really resonate with people and get to their heart and change how they look at things. And you can do your studies and read your anthropology books and all this stuff. That's not going to affect the world. Mm-hmm. What really affects the world is what people believe, what's powerful.
Why wouldn't knowing the truth affect the world?
Because it's too complicated. You just end up being a college professor.
It is complicated. It's better to have the truth. I mean, it really is much. It's honoring our diversity if we have the truth.
Well, that approach ends up in quagmires and people just having debates and never doing anything. The people who are really effective have short, simple, powerful messages based on something people can believe on, like our advertising, like the Third Reich, like political campaigns. How many people worry about the truth in a political campaign? It's finding a slogan, something that works. So you can... you were going to say something several times.
It's emotions that make the world go around, and that's what this appeals to, your emotions. Like, who cares whether George Washington chopped down the cherry tree or not? It's a nice story, and you get involved that way.
No, he liked John F. Kennedy's speeches, but most of his speeches were written by someone else.
Yep, there's been a lot of ghostwriting, a lot of things attributed to people.
It's a powerful speech, and I think it's made more powerful by attributing it to Chief Seattle and to the general public, and it's doing some good, hopefully.
That's another point that I think we haven't quite made and that we haven't looked at, and that is that the speech we heard, regardless of who wrote it, is very well written.
Yeah.
Whether you agree with it or not, it's a powerful statement of that point of view, and it's a very effective use of language. Yeah, I didn't know the answer to that until last January when I gave my talk to AAUW meeting. And a woman, right at the first, almost cut the whole thing down, raised her hand and said, "What about Ted Perry?" Most people have never heard of him. She happened to be a colleague of his and teach with him. So I talked to her afterwards, and I asked her that very question. How does he feel about it? And she said he's very angry. He's still mad about it.
He's mad about
not getting, for having written this speech, written the script, is quoted all over everywhere, and is very popular, and he doesn't get credit. It's all Chief Seattle, not
him. Well, that seems to me the answer then. I mean, things like this, I have his name on, you're saying,
sure.
Yeah, speech adapted by Perry, most of us wouldn't read it, that it would be on.
Yeah, okay, that's the point, though. It was on here, and it said all this nice stuff, and then the bomb said, Ted Perry. 1971. What would that mean to you? Is that another environmentalist? Another somebody else playing Indian or whatever.
Was it his choice in the credits on the original
documents? No.
He was, well, if I were him, I'd sue. That's what I
He was very surprised and upset when the program came out and he didn't get credit, according to what this woman told me. And he hasn't gotten over it.
Probably
might not
have
heard of Chief Seattle
if it hadn't
been for Ted Perry.
That's true. He should get some credit.
That's probably quite true. That he's really the person that's popularized this.
It's so typical of our commercial age that we exploit people.
Do Reader's Digest give him credit?
Yeah, the Reader's Digest talks about where it came from.
What article was that in? What month or year?
Oh, this is a couple years ago. July 1993.
Thank you.
Reader's Digest.
Who was the author?
Someone named Mary Murray. She didn't do the research. The person that really figured all this out was a German scholar named Rudolf Kaiser, who somehow, living in Germany, figured this whole thing out.
Because it's a large contingent of Germans who have a vast, deep interest in Indian and Western lore.
Yeah, actually.
Somebody should call this into 60 Minutes and let
him answer. Here's a German version of it, actually. Diese Erde ist uns heilig.
The speech still is popular and is quoted and used. So why? Because the FSA says it's a lie. It was never given by Chief Seattle. So why does it persist?
Why do you think?
Because there's a message there. The same thing Raytheon said.
The people don't know that it is.
So it doesn't give credit to the man who really wrote this.
And there's a great deal of mea culpa in America right now about the American Indians and Native Americans. And it makes us feel good to romanticize in this way. There's another problem here.
Okay, we have another problem over here.
Well, I see a problem that if, you know, it is certainly as powerful a message and as great as promotional for the environmental movement as it could possibly be. If it's exposed as inauthentic,
bogus.
And so as bogus,
then that is going to be a real blow, because so much of the things that the environmentalists are saying, some of them are bogus, some of them are overblown, and it'll really hurt the credibility of many of the people who are working in the field.
So then they should be honest in the first place, and they wouldn't have to worry about it.
Well,
that's the risk you take, what she just said. If you decide to go with it as authentic because it's effective, you take the chance of someone shooting you out of the water. That's what this article is. Right, this is an anti-environmental article, as you can tell by the title.
And very effective. If this lost its place in the bestseller list.
It's a beautiful children's
and
book.
And if they're given credit to the author, then they wouldn't have to fuss about
But neither it. Would it have, care. If it didn't have the credibility, I mean, if it didn't, granted it's, okay, if we accept that it's not authentic, and it is accredited to Ted, what's his name?
Perry.
Perry. Then this is just another wild eye environmentalist.
You would look in the very back of that at the credits and worry about that. It's a nice book for your kid. I'd buy it. I'd like them to read it, but I wouldn't worry about reading the last page. But that's what would
but
be
that's
honest.
Where it should be.
Well, I agree that it's not honest. It's totally unhonest what they did.
That's
I agree with that.
That man's writing is what.
I agree with that completely. But how many people would read it, as you said, if it had Ted Perry at the end of the...
I would. My grandkids would.
A great many people read Shakespeare and know that Portia's speech, which is a wonderful speech, was written by Shakespeare, not that Portia herself didn't say it. I think we can make a case for honesty.
Yeah, it could be in small, it should have been put in small print at the end.
It should be titled, "This is the speech that Chief Seattle would have made had he been Now there you take care of the whole thing. Bye, Ted Perry.
Okay, well, I think you see some of the quandaries and difficulties of trying to deal with this. As somebody, I think you pointed out, this isn't all unusual. All kinds of things are attributed to other people, especially things are attributed to Indian people throughout our history. A lot of the famous Indian speeches are not by the native people at all. Even something like Black Elk Speaks is really been filtered through and changed a lot by the white author who poet who took it down.
Well, you know, if you're talking about people being credited with things when they are not the origin of it, Shakespeare is full of things that people quote as original with Shakespeare, and he's actually quoting the Bible. So, you know, I mean, this is not...
Well, actually, Tim Perry tried to make background speeches that
speech
he read
is
before. Bowser, it's not really original.
Regardless as to who wrote it, and we accredit it to Shakespeare, let's take something by Mark Twain or any other author. We don't have to go with Shakespeare.
Well, there's a sense when something is... Even if it's misattributed and it's lasted for centuries and centuries, it has, regardless who wrote it, has some kind of authority. I mean, the writings of Socrates, a lot of debate over what Socrates, Plato actually said or who said it, but it's lasted 2,000, 2,500 years. When something's only been around 20 years and we find out who we thought said it, did or didn't say it, and instead of being 150 years old, it's only 20 years old, that probably does tend to undercut it some in our reaction to it.
I find this extremely disappointing. I mean, it's another, I've lost a little faith.
I've been told I shouldn't do this because of that. So, go ahead.
Again, I think that the important thing to me would be to know the authentic voice of a Native American and the diversity within their culture. And that I would imagine that you, if you researched, you would find, and I don't care if it sounds intellectual, I would prefer to know, some of the true Chief Seattles, you know, out there that actually do align with a lot of the sentiment.
Because I think it's a very common racist thing for a colonial power to use, you know, the people under them.
To have them saying what we want them to say.
And to romanticize. We romanticize, and to me, if she said over my grandfather, I'd be angry about this. Because it would be like, well, you're misrepresenting my grandfather. He wasn't this person who was an environmentalist. Just because it wasn't true. And, it would not feel respectful to me if I was a Native American.
You'd feel
a thing
exploited.
I would feel a bit exploited, yes.
Now, the problem with what you want to do, I can't demonstrate it to you here, but I could very easily. I had all my notes. Is how difficult and complex what you want to do is, both getting back to it in the first place, and secondly, when you do get back to something much more authentic than what we usually have, how inaccessible it is, because it is not only a different culture, it's not like a different European culture or Western culture, it's a really different culture.
The mindset.
And the symbolism, the metaphors and everything are just mind-boggling for a person not raised in that. Then we don't know the language, and to really get into any culture you got to know the language, so we're dealing with translations. A couple of examples of that, how this throws people. We usually like creation stories out of different cultures and pick them up. The Navajo have a creation story, a very powerful one. It's been translated, and they say it's an authentic translation of it, and the recounting of it is published in a book. It's 330 pages long. And it's really like wading through quicksand, trying to figure out what's going on in it, and keeping track of all the characters and what the things they're doing. Give you another example of the difficulty we have dealing with different cultures when we begin to get back to the original forms is there's a book called Indian Legends of the Pacific Northwest. It was edited by a librarian at Washington State University. And it's a book's favorite of lots of people that like to read it to kids. They're nice stories, and they're very understandable about volcanoes blowing up and floods and animals doing this or that. But they're nice, sort of cute, clean little stories. And I used to read them in Sunday school classes with kids. That's different kinds of creation stories. When you begin to get back to the real stories and legends of North Coast Indians and Plateau Indians lived here, they're not like that at all. And two ways in which they're really different than those stories is they've got a lot of sex in them, a lot of sexuality, and they've got a lot of what are called scatological references. Scatological, scat, excrement. There are a lot about defecation. For what, I don't know why, but you read those stories, there people or animals or birds, and they're always defecating here and there, and something's happening with it. And we don't understand that, how people can consider it so essential to their view of the world to talk about excrement, because we don't like doing that, and it's not in our stories much. Well, there's more of that in the Bible than most people like to admit. Or talking openly about sexuality. So when we took those stories, we lifted all that stuff out, and we left the parts that sort of made sense to us. So getting back to them is very difficult and complicated. Understanding them is more so.
Maybe the American Indian would like it more this positive attitude of Seattle than the real authentic stories too.
Well, that could be. Another thing we're doing with this, it's another trap we fall into, and what you'd have to be careful about, is when we talk about Chief Seattle, we're talking, even if we thought it was authentic, we're saying this is what Indians, if we say this is what Indians think, we're taking something supposedly said 150 years ago and saying this is what Indians think. Mm-hmm. That would be like looking at what Governor Stevens said 150 years ago and saying, that's what you think. That's what we think today is what our ancestors of seven generations ago thought. We don't do that to ourselves. We say, well, we've developed since then. We've changed. That was their ideas. They're old-fashioned. We've thrown off those racist ideas and so on. That's what we say about ourselves, but we're very prone when we talk about Indians to want to think of them as being the way they were when they looked like this.
Exactly.
Modern Indians don't look like that. They dress up that and they want to impress white people or have some kind of a festival or powwow, but they aren't walking around looking like this or the way these pictures look in the book. They dress like we do. They drive pickup trucks and cars and everything else. The Indian has changed enormously since 1850 to 1995. And you're not going to understand modern Indians by thinking they're the same people that were back there. They're walking around in blankets and headdresses and with tomahawks or whatever. But we're very prone to doing that, sort of casting them in that time and freezing them there and saying that's who they are, even now. So that's a dangerous part of using that speech, as far as Indians are concerned.
Okay.